From Pacifica Network, this is Democracy Now!
Although we'll still have a significant presence overseas, under the plan I'm announcing today, over the next 10 years, we will bring home about 60,000 to 70,000 uniformed personnel and about 100,000 members and civilian employees.
President Bush announces the largest global realignment of U.S. forces since the Cold War. We speak with scholar Chalmers Johnson.
The new bases are being opened in some of the most autocratic and military dictatorships that exist around the world, whereas they're actually withdrawing troops from two of the genuine democracies that did not join the coalition.
Then, after our interview with Hustler magazine publisher Larry Flynt, Democracy Now! Was deluged with emails saying we shouldn't have talked to him. Today, a debate between two leading feminists about pornography. And are hundreds of sex workers from around the country preparing to come to New York for the Republican National Convention? We'll speak with a sex workers' rights advocate. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. In Venezuela, international election observers have confirmed President Hugo Chavez fairly won the national referendum on Sunday, despite accusations from the opposition that the election results were a, quote, gigantic fraud. Cesar Gaviria, the head of the Organization of American States and former president of Colombia, said the election monitors had not found, quote, any element of fraud. In Baghdad, a mortar attack in the heart of the city's business district has killed at least 7 people, including 2 children. Another 49 people were injured. In Najaf, hundreds of unarmed Shiites from across Iraq are arriving in the holy city to act as human shields for cleric Muqtada al-Sadr. The Independent of London reports 2,000 Shiites have pledged to die if needed to help stop the U.S. from attacking the Imam Ali Shrine, one of the holiest sites in the Muslim world. Meanwhile, a delegation of 60 members of the Iraqi National Conference have been forced to postpone a scheduled trip to Najaf because the mission could not get a military escort for the dangerous journey from Baghdad. The delegation was hoping to meet with Sadr to persuade him to disarm his Mehdi army and turn it into a political party. The Independent also is reporting the U.S.-backed Najaf police have begun enforcing their ban on non-embedded journalists in Najaf. One journalist from Al Arabiya was arrested yesterday. Police also fired shots at a hotel where most journalists stay. A police lieutenant told journalists at the hotel, quote, "We are going to open fire on this hotel. We are going to smash it up. I will kill you all. You did this all to yourselves," he said. An American journalist has been kidnapped in Nasiriyah while he was working on a documentary about threatened archaeological sites in war zones. The journalist was identified as Mika Garan, the founder of Four Corners Media. Israel has announced it has launched a psychological war against thousands of Palestinian prisoners who are on the third day of a hunger strike to protest jail conditions. Prison officers have set up barbecues near the cells of the detained Palestinians. Guards have been told to eat in front of the hunger strikers, and guards have confiscated salt from the cells of hunger strikers who intended to use it to stop themselves from becoming dehydrated. Israel's internal security minister said last week, quote, "They can strike for a day, a month, even starve to death, as far as I'm concerned," he said. In education news, the New York Times is reporting that a new federal study has concluded children attending charter schools score lower on standardized tests than students at regular public schools. According to the New York Times, the Bush administration buried the federal study, and the Education Department released the study without any public announcement. The results are a major setback for the Bush administration, which has strongly backed charter schools. The Times reports charters are expected to grow exponentially under the federal education law, No Child Left Behind. The U.S. Census Bureau is coming under criticism for preparing reports for the Department of Homeland Security that documented the location and country of origin of Arab Americans living in the United States based on zip code. 40 civic, faith-based, and civil liberties groups have issued a joint statement expressing concern that the reports undermine trust in the Census Bureau and unfairly target Arab Americans. The group cites similar information gathering in the 1940s that led to the internment of Japanese Americans. The Census Bureau has said the information was used only to determine at which U.S. airports signage in Arabic is necessary. Officials have not said whether similar information about any other minority population was obtained. In San Francisco today, a decorated combat veteran is expected to file a petition challenging a so-called stop-loss order that requires reservists to remain in the military beyond their term of enlistment. This marks the first legal challenge to the Army's current stop-loss program. Meanwhile, in Texas, the military has called up for duty a most unlikely candidate for duty, Master Sergeant Luis Jaime Trevino of McAllen, Texas. He is a 57-year-old Vietnam vet. He's afflicted with skin cancer, partially deaf, and suffers from high blood pressure. Trevino said of the call for duty, quote, "I was very shocked. If he doesn't report for duty on September 15th, he will face jail time." Trevino was called up because he remains on the Army's individual ready reserve. The IRR has been widely criticized as a backdoor draft because it forces veterans who've already served their time to be called for duty if needed. Trevino is a refueling specialist, an expert in petroleum, oils, and lubricants. Trevino said, quote, "If I have to go, I'll go. That's my job. I'm not a coward. The only concern I have is my skin cancer and my age. I'm pushing 58. I'm an old dingbat," he said. In New York, Mayor Michael Bloomberg yesterday suggested that the First Amendment rights of free speech and free assembly are privileges that could be lost if abused. This according to a report in Newsday. Bloomberg said, quote, "People who avail themselves of the opportunity to express themselves, they will not abuse that privilege, because if we start to abuse our privileges, then we lose them, and nobody wants that." Meanwhile, organizers from the group Not in Our Name rallied at City Hall yesterday to call on Bloomberg to allow for a massive anti-war rally to take place in Central Park the day before the Republican convention on August 29th.
World public opinion must and will have a platform to ring true in this society. In every city, in every town, there is a place where people gather to show their opposition. In D.C., it's the Mall. In Mexico City, it's the Zocalo. In San Francisco, it's Civic Center or Golden Gate Park. And in New York City, that place that we gather to show our opposition is Central Park. It has been that place for decades, and we will continue to fight for that to be a central gathering place. It is imperative that we take up this battle now.
Tanya Mayo, a national organizer for Not in Our Name. And the beer company Miller and Rolling Stone magazine are coming under criticism for a new promotion celebrating the 50th anniversary of rock and roll. The brewery and magazine have collaborated in producing 8 commemorative beer cans featuring the photos of rock legends. Artists chosen include Elvis Presley, Blondie, Alice Cooper, Bon Jovi, Def Leppard, and and Willie Nelson. The artists share one thing in common. They are all white. Robert Thompson, a professor of pop culture at Syracuse University, criticized the selection since African-American artists largely invented rock and roll. He told the Associated Press, quote, "It would be like doing a set of cans of six great impressionist painters and not including any French people on it."
Nothing but a hound dog been snooping around my door. You ain't nothing but a hound dog been snooping around my door. You can wag your tail, but I ain't gonna feed you no more. You told me you was high class, but I can see through that. Yes, you told me you was high.
Big Mama Thornton singing Hound Dog, recorded in 1952, 4 years before Elvis Presley recorded his version. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Bush announced plans Monday to recall as many as 70,000 troops from military bases in Europe and Asia as part of a global rearrangement of forces.
Although we'll still have a significant presence overseas, under the plan I'm announcing today, over the next 10 years, we will bring home about 60,000 to 70,000 uniformed personnel and about 100,000 members and civilian employees.
In one of the biggest shifts of U.S. forces since the Cold War, the repositioning is to unfold gradually over 7 to 10 years and cut the 230,000 overseas U.S. service members by one-third. The general outlines of the redeployment plan have been known for months, namely pulling troops out of Germany and South Korea, bringing most of them home, establishing a series of forward operating posts in Central Asia. The Bush administration would build training camps and smaller bases, mainly in the former Soviet satellites of Eastern Europe, that could be used for rapid deployments to the Middle East in a bid to make the military more flexible. The realignment drew criticism from former NATO commander Wesley Clark, who said the plan, quote, will significantly undermine U.S. national security. The realignment is expected to have the greatest impact in Germany, where 30,000 troops will be withdrawn along with the thousands of local jobs that depend on U.S. forces. President Bush said his goal is to ease the burden on U.S. troops, but the plan offered no immediate relief to the 125,000 U.S. troops now in Iraq and nearly 20,000 in Afghanistan. Nevertheless, the announcement gave the president a chance to talk about bringing troops home at a time when his opponent, Senator John Kerry, has pledged to substantially reduce U.S. troop levels in Iraq.
The world has changed a great deal, and our posture must change with it for the sake of our military families, for the sake of our taxpayers, and so we can be more effective at projecting our strength and spreading freedom and peace.
President Bush making his case for the major global troop realignment. We're joined now by Chalmers Johnson, a leading scholar of Asia and U.S.-Asian relations and the founder of the Japan Policy Research Institute. His latest book is Sorrows of Empire, Militarism, Secrecy, and the End of the Republic. Chalmers Johnson, welcome to Democracy Now! Can you respond to President Bush's announcement?
In talking about our over 700 military bases abroad, the story is in the details, and Bush simply doesn't tell us the details. He omits to tell us the bases that are being opened, is distinct from the ones that are being closed. For all of the endless talk by this administration about our support for democracy, He doesn't tell us that the new bases are being opened in some of the most autocratic and military dictatorships that exist around the world, whereas they're actually withdrawing troops from two of the genuine democracies that did not join the coalition of the consenting, so-called, namely South Korea and Germany. There is a very open question of whether this will actually occur, despite what he said. Secretary Rumsfeld is in great trouble with the military, and he and above all Douglas Feith, his assistant who's been in charge of this, seem to have no real knowledge at all of inter-service rivalries and how strong they can be. The ease with which the Pentagon can subvert this action is great. On the other hand, if they really mean it, I'd have to admit we all ought to support them. Just this past weekend, we had a Marine Corps helicopter crash at the Marine Corps Air Station at Futenma in the middle of Okinawa, and crashed into the building of a university there. Fortunately, no one was killed because it's summer. But this has been an accident waiting to happen for years, and it did just happen. And Rumsfeld has been the first Secretary of Defense to visit Okinawa with our 38 American military bases since Cheney was Secretary of Defense back in the first Bush administration. The Democrats simply never paid any attention to it at all. And we understand that Rumsfeld was actually shocked when he flew over Futenma and saw that it was bigger than Central Park, and located right in the middle of one of Okinawa's largest cities, and commented that, you know, no ally should treat another allied nation in this manner. It's an accident waiting to happen. So to the extent they really mean it, that's fine. But most of us don't believe they really mean it, that they're moving troops out of Germany also because of the fact that our status of forces agreements with these countries normally stipulate that the United States cannot be held responsible for environmental damage. Germany has recently forced a change in the status of forces agreement, making us responsible for very considerable environmental pollution around our bases. And the Americans now want to move to places, former communist countries like Romania and Bulgaria, that are so poor, they said, come here, you can be as dirty as you want to be. It also is clear the high command in Europe has said, like hell are we going to move to a backwater like Constanta, Romania. We're staying in Stuttgart, right next door to the Armed Forces Ski Center at Garmisch in the Bavarian Alps. And none of them seem to realize, I mean, after all, none of them have ever served in the armed forces, how many buildings 70,000 German troops in Germany occupy, and how poor a country like Romania or Bulgaria, how poor the infrastructure actually is. So we'll see. At the same time, they don't say anything about 14 permanent bases being built in Iraq. Four are already built: the Tal el Air Base, Baghdad, the one in the north near Mosul, and the one over on the border with Syria. They don't say anything about the bases in Djibouti, in the Saharan Desert, in Mali, and places like that, in our attempt to get some kind of a military base to control the oil in the Gulf of Guinea, and numerous other things like this that simply aren't mentioned. So what I fear is this doesn't really come so much either from the Secretary of Defense or even from Bush as it does from Karl Rove. It's the attempt, once again, to manipulate the gullible by suggesting that we're all of a sudden turning responsible and careful and concerned about the welfare of families of people serving in the armed forces or of people forced to live cheek by jowl with military bases around the world, whereas this is simply nonsense. I mean, if you join the Marine Corps today and happen to have a family, I guarantee you they give you information on how to apply for food stamps as you join, simply because you can't possibly live on what they're paid. One of the things that does worry me is in the case of Japan, it's as if these characters are treating Japan as if it were the 51st state and they can just do anything they want. They don't seem to understand the politics of the fact that though the Japanese government likes the security treaty with the United States, they know full well that if the troops of the 3rd Marine Division that are currently in Okinawa were located anywhere near a major mainland city like, say, Yokohama, they'd have been thrown out 30 years ago. The Japanese public simply wouldn't tolerate it. Therefore, they're quarantined down in a Japanese equivalent of Puerto Rico, namely the poorest prefecture in the country, and which has distinct cultural differences from Japan, namely Okinawa. Now they're talking about moving some of these Marines to new bases in the Northern Territory or Queensland of Australia, and Prime Minister Howard may not last more than another couple of months, so that may not happen. They're talking about putting them on the sides of Mount Fuji at the firing range there. They're proposing a new military, joint military command between Fort Lewis, Washington, and Japan. It'll be located at Camp Zama near Yokohama. Once already, these people don't read Japanese, obviously. They don't know what's going on, but the Japanese press, every locality that is being designated as soon to receive a few Marines, is protesting like crazy, like hell you'll put them here. So that, as I say, this is it's being treated with too much credulity, notably by the New York Times, which lately seems incapable of critical judgment. We have to see how this comes out. They talk about how it's been planned and discussed by Bush for years. That's simply nonsense. There's one other element in it, I think, that ought to be recognized. One of the things that's coming up next year in 2005 is an absolute firestorm in Congress over base closings domestically, which is already required by law. The two mother hens of the Defense Facilities Subcommittee of the Senate Armed Services Committee are K. Bailey Hutchinson of Texas and Dianne Feinstein of California. They'd fight to keep military bases open in their states because a lot of people are employed by the military-industrial complex and by the armed services. It's part of American militarism. One of the things that Hutchinson and Feinstein have done is, in the last appropriation, they established a commission opposed by the White House to close foreign military bases and keep them open in America. It always seemed like that Bush and the Pentagon could get around this if they wanted to, but it may be that they're beginning to prepare the ground for a big base closings fight next year by easing off the serious opposition that would come from the states with the largest number of bases, namely Texas and California, and then ganging up on the less politically potent ones elsewhere. That's just speculation, but it's certainly something that is well known in the when the issue of military bases comes up.
Chalmers Johnson, author of Sorrows of Empire. We're going to come back because I want to ask you about Japan and what is happening with the U.S. pressuring Japan to drop Article 9 of the Constitution in just a minute.
Well, I feel like loving, feel like running, I feel like hugging a fine little bunny. Party, 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 party all day long. Gonna get on the wall and call on my telephone. Well, listen to your blues, yes, you sure sound fine. Well, listen to your shouting, baby, you sure sound fine. Well, I listen to yours, now you listen to mine. Well, I'm rocking and rolling and rolling and rocking all right. Yes, I'm rocking and rolling, rolling and rocking all right. Night. Well, if you ever heard the blues the way it should be played, you want to sing it the rest of your day, rocking, rolling, rocking, rolling, rocking. Yes, rock me, baby, give me boogie and beat. I'm gonna love you and give.
Big Joe Turner singing "Battle of the Blues" in 1947, a song that mentions rock and roll 7 years before Bill Haley sang "Rock Around the Clock." This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're talking to Chalmers Johnson. His book is called Sorrows of Empire, about the massive redeployment that President Bush announced yesterday. Chalmers Johnson, General Colin Powell, Secretary of State, said that if Japan is to join the UN Security Council, the U.S. would support that if they were to drop Article 9 of the Japanese Constitution. Your response?
All of a sudden, you just have to say that the people in our government seem to be culturally the most tin-eared human beings on Earth. I mean, let me mention one thing. I mean, General Powell is indeed made a career in the Army. Does he know that we have, that the headquarters of the 8th Army in South Korea have been in downtown Seoul, that is a city of 11 million people, for the last 50 years in the old headquarters of the Japanese colonialists? You don't have to be a genius in cultural affairs to realize this has always been an insult to the Koreans. They just finally agreed a couple of years from now to move them out of there. Well, similarly, Article 9 of the Japanese Constitution, in which Japan renounces the use of armed force in international relations, was in fact Japan's form of apology for World War II to the nations of East Asia that it had victimized. We've now had Richard Armitage, Powell's deputy, and then Powell himself, now come out and say, we regard Article 9, which, by the way, it's in the Constitution that General MacArthur wrote, we regard Article 9 as an obstacle to our global strategic imperial plans. And if you want us to back you up in going into the UN Security Council, we want you to amend your Constitution and get rid of it. Well, this has produced unbelievable outrage in Japan, even from conservative politicians that say it's simply flagrant interference in the domestic affairs of Japan. And I hope it will actually energize the defenders of Article 9, who are getting few in number as we get farther and farther away from people who remember Hiroshima and Nagasaki and World War II. But it certainly was not a pleasant affair, and it reveals, I think most seriously to the rest of the world, that Japan is simply an open satellite of the United States, that its foreign policy revolves entirely around Washington, D.C., that Prime Minister Koizumi wouldn't do anything without first consulting the Bush administration, and that alone will kill its presence in the United Nations, simply because everybody's going to recognize Japan in the U.N. is simply, in the Security Council, is to give the United States another vote, which reminds people of back during the heyday of the Soviet Union when they got votes for Ukraine and Belarus and things like that. We all knew these were just further votes for Moscow. So that it's, again, you have to think we need a State Department headed by somebody who actually knows what the word diplomacy means.
Chalmers Johnson, how do you respond to General Wesley Clark saying that this redeployment will compromise the war on terror?
Well, I don't see that it has anything to do with the war on terror. That is to say, the war on terror, we've applied wrongly an overly military approach to it from the beginning. There is no question that the situation is worse today than it was on 9/11. That is, between 1993 and 2001, including 9/11, al-Qaeda managed to carry out 5 major bombings internationally. In the 3 years since 9/11, down to and including the attacks in Riyadh, the suicide bombings in Istanbul, the bombings of the commuter railroads in Madrid, they've carried out well over 20. Rumsfeld asked last October, you know, we need a measure of how we're doing in the war on terrorism. Well, baby, we've got a measure. We're losing it. We're losing it rather badly, and it's because of an excessively military approach to these problems without any real understanding of the needs to alter our foreign policy in order to do the only known way to deal with terrorism, to try and separate the activists who are incorrigible from their passive supporters. The only way so that you can get information from their passive supporters on who the activists are and arrest them in courts of law. The only way to separate the activists from their passive supporters is to recognize the legitimacy of the grievances of their passive supporters, grievances that are easily illustrated in the Middle East by the fact that we have American troops in Iraq, that we are the world's sole supporters of the Sharon government in Israel, and its extremely militaristic policies toward the essentially defenseless Palestinians. The result is that the entire Islamic world are now passive supporters of al-Qaeda. I've spent a fair amount of time traveling in Indonesia. It's the world's largest Islamic country. And I guarantee you that until very recently, Islam was carried very lightly in Indonesia, more or less the way an Italian man carries his Catholicism. 4 or 5 years ago, 80% of the population were pro-American. It was one of the easiest places on earth to visit. Now, 80% of the public distrusts the United States and is sympathetic to al-Qaeda. T-shirts with pictures of Osama bin Laden are common on any kid in Jakarta today. Only George Bush could have brought about such a disastrous outcome.
Chalmers Johnson, I want to thank you for being with us, author of Sorrows of Empire, Militarism, Secrecy, and the End of the Republic. His previous book was Blowback, The Costs and Consequences of American Empire. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. 2 weeks ago, we interviewed the controversial publisher of Hustler magazine, Larry Flint. Flint is well known for publishing an image of a woman being put through a meat grinder, for putting feminist icon Gloria Steinem on a wanted poster, depicting women in a manner many people say is outright demeaning and encourages violence against women. At the same time, Flint is also known as a fierce defender of free speech and the First Amendment. His personal victory at the Supreme Court defending the First Amendment is well known. We had a lot of responses to the interview. Many people said we shouldn't have even interviewed Larry Flint. On the program, we talked to him about President Bush, his lawsuit against Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld, the Clinton impeachment hearings, and more. Today, we're going to have a debate around the issue of pornography. But first, an excerpt from that interview with Larry Flint, when we talked about the issue of women's rights and exploitation of women. Here's an excerpt. What about the criticism, Larry Flint, that you have profited for so many years off of the exploitation and degradation of women, like showing a woman in a meat grinder? Your response to that?
Well, most of the criticism comes from the radical feminist movement, who really only claim to fame is to urge a bunch of ugly women to march. But other than that, I haven't received criticism. I've had thousands of models pose for me. I have never had one, not one case where a model has said she felt she was exploited, or
but that the imagery. I'm surprised you would say the radical feminist movement, the very same kind of words that people like Rush Limbaugh talk about when women are standing up and fighting for their rights.
Well, I support the women's movement, equal rights, equal pay, non-discrimination in the workplace, but I just can't convince myself that Andrea Dworkin and Gloria Steinem speak for the average woman in America. I talk to average women all the time. Most of the officers in my company are women, and I just don't see the connection. When I'm using the word feminism or radical, I'm talking about the fringe. I'm not really talking about the average American woman.
Let me read to you from something. This came out after the film about you, and Gloria Steinem wrote an op-ed piece in the New York Times, and she said, unlike his film character, the real Mr. Flint is hardly an unwavering advocate of free speech. Indeed, other feminists and I have been attacked in Hustler for using our First Amendment rights to protest pornography. In my case, that meant calling me dangerous and putting my picture on a most wanted poster. I was also depicted as the main character in a photo story that ended up in my sex sexual mutilation. Given the number of crimes that seem to imitate pornography, this kind of attack does tend to get your attention. And she says, so now I'm not grateful to Mr. Flint. Gloria Steinem says, I'm not grateful to Mr. Flint for protecting my freedom, as the film and its enthusiasts suggest I should be, no more than I would be to a racist or fascist publisher whose speech is protected by the Constitution. My question is, would men be portrayed as inviting, deserving, and even enjoying their own pain and degradation as women are in Mr. Flint's life work? And she says, Gloria Steinem writes, suppose Mr. Flint specialized in such images as a young African-American man trussed up like a deer and tied to the luggage rack of a white hunter's car, or a nude white man fed into a meat grinder. Those are some of the milder ways in which Hustler portrays women. Your response, Mr. Flint?
Well, nothing that I'm going to say is going to change Gloria Steinem's attitude. She was very useful to the women's movement in the 60s, but she's remained very much in the 60s. I think she's out of touch, and as I said earlier, I don't think she's speaking for the average American woman.
But what if she is speaking for herself? What if she is speaking, she is just voicing her opinion on, would you have something like this, African-American splayed out with degrading images? That, I guess one of the questions is, you have taken on power your whole life, and the criticism of a number of feminists is that you reinforce the images of the powerful with these images of, for example, women being mutilated, like being put through a meat grinder.
No, you see, that, you know, that is totally unfounded, misinterpreted to a very large degree. I mean, we have our own base of readership, and we do a lot of outrageous political and social satire and a lot of black humor. Some of it is offensive, but if the First Amendment gives me a right to do anything, it gives me the right to be offensive. And if Gloria Steinem is offensive, then she shouldn't read the magazine.
Larry Flint, in an interview we did with him several weeks ago, Larry Flint, the founder of Hustler magazine. We're joined right now on the telephone by Susie Bright, who is the author of Mommy's Little Girl, Susie Bright on Sex, Motherhood, Pornography, and Cherry Pie, a former Salon.com columnist. And Susan Bryson joins us in a radio studio from Dartmouth, a professor of philosophy at Dartmouth, and author of Aftermath, Violence and the Remaking of a Self. Susan Bryson, let's begin with you. Your response to Larry Flint.
Well, I was going to say, when you introduced this as a debate between two leading feminists about porn, that I'm not sure you're going to get much of a debate between me and Susie Bright, because I'm pro-sex, I'm pro-erotica, I'm anti-violence against women, anti-sexual torture and sexual murder is entertainment, and I think she agrees with me about these things. I think you asked Larry Flint just the right hard questions towards the end of that interview, but he didn't answer them. He didn't give satisfactory answers to them. It's not enough to say if Gloria Steinem is offended, she shouldn't read the magazine. I mean, I'm wondering if he would say the same thing about the photos of lynchings of black men and sometimes women circulating in the early 20th century in the U.S. There's been a lot of discussion about these and the aftermath of the photos of the torture at Abu Ghraib. I mean, would he say, suppose we still lived in society in which people got off on seeing these photos of black men being lynched, and the people who sent these postcards and who received them, you know, clearly got a kick out of it. I would say there was even some kind of a sexual kick that some people got from these. Would he say about to those of us who would be very concerned and outraged if these things were still circulating, well, if you're offended by them, you don't have to look at them. You know, what's it to you? Just don't look. First of all, Gloria Steinem isn't talking about speech that is merely offensive. She's talking about harmful speech. Feminists have been talking about that since 1980. We're not talking about offensive speech. We're talking about harmful speech. So it's just a red herring to say, well, if someone's offended, they just shouldn't bother looking at the stuff.
Susie Bright, let me get your response.
Well, I was fascinated by his discussion with you because he was so progressive on so many issues, and then he comes up with this incredible, vicious attack about ugly women. You're like, what happened? Who are you? And what occurred to me is that he and Gloria Steinem have this rather amazing blind spot, as if they were preserved in amber in some long-ago debate where actually neither of them recognize a very important part of the average American woman's experience, since he brought that up. The average American woman has been through a revolution in the last couple decades where our desire for sexual self-interest and expression has changed the way we look at everything, from the women's revolution in healthcare regarding gynecology and childbirth, the whole boom in vibrators and acknowledgement of masturbation, you know, the popularity of something like the vagina monologues, women's erotic writing and film, the emphasis on communication between partners. These are subjects that both Larry and Gloria act as if they didn't happen. It's not part of the history that they're a part of. And then in the meantime, they sort of look at each other and don't see what effect they had or what they ever had in common in terms of sexual liberation or women's liberation, which is a bit bizarre to me. I mean, Hustler, it's interesting, until the women's movement attacked his magazine for that meat grinder issue, which ironically was also his conversion to Christianity issue. What Hustler was known for, the revolution they made in publishing, was that they published explicit pictures of women's genitals, which had never been done before. I mean, Hugh Hefner and Bob Guccione and all those avoided this like the plague because it was considered kind of ugly and taboo and you know, disgusting. And here comes Flint. He goes, no, this is the essence of male heterosexuality. This is what we love. This is what it's all about. This is what I'm going to glory in. This is what I'm going to revel in. He was then criticized by some people, including some feminists, who saw those pictures. And instead of saying, the celebration of the vulva, they said, this is hideous, and it's treating women like pieces of meat. That was the famous expression. And then what does Flint do? He does what Hustler always does, which is vicious, vicious satire, especially of public figures that they hate. And just as he decimated Jerry Falwell and impugned his childhood and reputation, they went on a rampage and they did a whole lot of making fun of this. Like, oh, really? You think what we're doing is anti-woman? Well, we'll show you. And then you have this satire about food and sex. The pictorial that has now become an urban legend was not designed as a turn-on in the least. It was a satiric pictorial, and yet it got taken out of context as like, well, this is what Hustler prints, and their membership, sits around and gets off on this. This is what their audience does. And
Susie Bright, we have to break, but we're going to come back to Susie Bright, author of Mommy's Little Girl, and Susan Bryson, professor of philosophy at Dartmouth, author of Aftermath, Violence and the Remaking of a Self. Stay with us.
Blues falling down like hail, blues falling down like hail, blues falling. to pass the time away. To pass the time away.
Hellhound on My Trail, a 1936 recording by Robert Johnson. His music would go on to influence many of rock's biggest acts, including the Rolling Stones, Led Zeppelin, and Eric Clapton. This is Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're talking about pornography with Susie Bright, who is a former Salon.com columnist, series editor of Best American Erotica, and Susan Bryson, professor of philosophy at Dartmouth, author of the book Aftermath. Professor Bryson, your response to Susie Bright's comments.
Well, I don't want to speak for Gloria Steinem. I do think that it wasn't the sexual explicitness of these photos of women that she was primarily concerned about, but let me speak for myself. I'm not primarily concerned about that, and that's why I would love to have a new word for what some people call pornography. I don't think it's possible any longer to have, or ever was, to have a productive feminist debate about pornography, given the very different things people mean by this. I'm in favor of sexual expression, and much of what some people would call pornography, I would find sexually liberating, just as Susie Bright would. So I'm at a loss for a word, but what I'm concerned about is what I might call violently misogynistic hate speech, and I think that's what Steinem was concerned about as well, and it isn't necessarily sexually explicit. I mean, one of the worst examples that feminists cite was the cartoon in the May 83 issue of Penthouse that showed a man penetrating a woman from behind and holding a pistol to the back of her head, and the caption reads, "Oh, you don't have to worry about getting pregnant. I've taken all the precautions." Now, admittedly, that wasn't something people were getting off on. That was something people were laughing at. That was funny. I'm saying we should be questioning our attitudes as a society if many of us, some of us even, find such cartoons funny. If they find photos of or depictions of sexual murder, sexual torture, arousing, what does that say about us as a society? And what does it say to those actual victims of sex crimes, that we treat their real pain as fodder for entertainment?
Susie Bright.
I totally understand the frustration about how pornography is defined, because it just seems to be one of those buzzwords that provokes different issues in different people. For me, it tends to be a discussion either about what do you think of the aesthetics of explicit sexual expression, how it influences people. Is it artistic? Is it moronic? Is it vulgar? Is it uplifting? What do you think of the effect of images and words? And then the other side of pornography is, what do you think of it as a labor issue? What do you think of the corporatization of the sex industry, of the strange class differences and kind of third-tier aspect of the film industry that it occupies right now? What do you think of the fact that Britney Spears' breakthrough videos were directed by a mainstream porn director? There's a whole labor issue of what it's like to work both behind the scenes or in front of the camera in this business, which is just chock full of controversy, to say the least, and has been just beginning to be discussed by economists and social scientists and people, obviously people in the industry, who feel like their livelihoods and their image and their futures are at stake. When it comes to what do we make of cruel jokes and things that make fun of people in a brutal way, it does need to be analyzed, and not just in a like, oh my God, that's horrifying way, but why do we make fun of certain things at certain times? You know, there's a whole group of people who make this their point of focus. Why do people make vicious AIDS jokes, at a certain time? What is that relieving? What is the psychological motivation behind that? Why that kind of cruelty? It's interesting, the cartoon she describes is not what would be in vogue in the vulgar cartoon world of today. Isn't that strange? Not because people got nicer or better, but because, interestingly, and we see this in, you know, contemporary images all around us, both real and fantastical. The societal tension right now is about emasculation and submissive men, and men being made fun of or degraded in a like, oh, you're nothing but a little girl, or I'm gonna make a mockery of you, I'm going to rape you. So, you know, now we have and I'm not pointing at any particular magazine, but this is, if you look at the kind of underground the kind of humor that makes a lot of people sick to the stomach and other people like laugh in embarrassment, the topics have changed and they will continue to change, and they need to be looked at in terms of, you know, what is this shadow side that's haunting us? What is the American sexual zeitgeist that gives rise to certain feelings? I think
I wanted to switch gears for a minute because we only have a few minutes and we have one more guest, but I wanted to ask Susan Bryson on a very different issue around, right now, cable television is focusing on two major cases, almost around the clock. The case of Lacey Peterson, the brutal murder of Lacey Peterson and her husband Scott Peterson on trial. And then also Lori Hacking and her husband now went to court for the first time, Mark Hacking, her brutal murder, though they haven't found her body. And the way the media covers these issues, clearly, with the amount of time they've spent on them, you would think people learn a great deal about domestic violence and about what the crisis is. But I doubt people are any more illuminated now than they were from the first day. And I wanted to ask you about this issue.
Right. I would agree with you. And I would classify much media coverage of these cases as yet another form of sexual murder as entertainment. And instead of getting us to be more informed about what actual victims of domestic violence and other forms of abuse go through, it has a kind of distancing effect. You know, we are not like them. We can't imagine that happening to us. And I think there should be more focus on the more mundane cases of sexual torture, sexual murder that are happening all the time, so that we don't just pathologize a couple of alleged perpetrators and try to figure out, well, what's the matter with them?
Well,
why would anyone
do know?
That?
What should we know about domestic violence and murder? I mean, in these cases, no one has been convicted yet, but in terms of, since they're spending this amount of time on the issue.
Right. That it's more common than most people realize, that it's not being perpetrated by just a few monsters who are not of us, that we should be looking at our society and taking responsibility for the society in which we raise our boys and in which many men come to feel entitled to abuse women.
We're talking to Susan Bryson, professor of philosophy at Dartmouth, author of Aftermath, Violence and the Remaking of a Self, and Susie Bright, author of Mommy's Little Girl, Susie Bright on Sex, Motherhood, Pornography, and Cherry Pie. Susan Bryson, you've also written an extended piece called The Torture Connection, When Photographs from Abu Ghraib Can't Be Distinguished from Good Old American Pornography, in quotes. It's not just the torture we should be questioning.
Right. And I thought it was, I mean, as appalling as the events at Abu Ghraib were, it was fascinating to see the discussion of fact and fiction that came out of all of that. Both the Boston Globe and the Daily Mirror published photos, presented them as fact, that turned out to be staged pornographic photos of U.S. soldiers raping Iraqi women. And so we were in this situation where actual photos, pornographic photos, were being presented as actual torture, and then the photos of the actual torture at Abu Ghraib were being called hardcore porn. So it raises this interesting question about what does it say about a society in which, you know, torture is viewed as porn and porn is viewed as torture. I mean, leaving aside the difficulty of categorizing porn for one moment, I think that the debate about these photos should have gotten some of us to see that things aren't always as they appear to be, that we can't always assume that people who look like they're being tortured are. But likewise, we can't always assume that, you know, they're not.
And of course, there were pictures that, for example, Seymour Hersh has alluded to that were boys who were being raped by soldiers as well. And he has talked about seeing the images, saying what we haven't seen perhaps is worse than what we have seen.
Right. Right.
Susie Bright, just we only have a few more minutes before we move to our last segment, but your response.
Well, I was had an extra special shock when I first saw the photos from Abu Ghraib, because in addition to seeing this like grotesque depiction of infantile rage and helplessness, you know, the sort of special kink of bizarre emasculation, I had to reflect on my own work as an erotic editor, where I see thousands of manuscripts cross my desk from amateurs and professionals, and trends come and go. And the trend right now is there's lots and lots of submissive male fantasies. Of course, these are very whimsical and they're orgasm-oriented.
We only have 10 seconds, so
yeah.
if you can make your point fast.
Why is it going on? What is the perverse Peter Pan? What is this consciousness? It comes out in different contexts, both consensual and non-consensual. But what it means is a real important topic for contemplation.
Well, Susie Bright, I want to thank you for being with us, author of Mommy's Little Girl, former Salon.com columnist, series editor of Best American Erotica, and Susan Bryson, professor of philosophy at Dartmouth, author of Aftermath, Violence and the Remaking of a Self. It's a discussion that needs to continue, certainly. We saw this in the New York Daily News on June 28th, it said, with thousands of Republicans set to invade the city this summer, high-priced escorts and strippers are preparing for one grand old party. Agencies are flying in extra call girls from around the globe to meet the expected demand during the August 30th, September 2nd gathering at Madison Square Garden. We're joined right now by Juhu Thukral, director of the Sex Workers Project at the Urban Justice Center. Last year, the project published a report, Revolving Door, an analysis of street-based prostitution in New York City. First, is this true in terms of what's happening for the convention?
This may be happening, but that's not what we're hearing from prostitutes, and that's not the concerns that we are putting forward. The thing is,
are there preparations being made, and does it happen at the Democratic and Republican conventions around the country? Like in San Diego, it says the 96 Republican Convention and Escort Service in Search of Delegate Dollars change its name to GOP Good Old Fashioned Pleasure.
You know, the sex workers that we're concerned about are the ones who are out there on the streets, the ones who are already in very vulnerable and marginalized situations. And in fact, sex workers who are out there near the Madison Square Garden and the hot zone for the convention, and in fact throughout the city, are going to have problems receiving services that they're used to receiving. Outreach vans are not going to be able to go out and get them. There's going to be an increased police presence. So, you know, while on the one hand, there's a story about prostitutes coming into the city to work, a lot of local prostitutes are saying that they don't want to work that week because of fear of undercover police officers, because of just increased sweeps during that time, because the city wants to put its best face on. They don't want street-based prostitutes being the first thing that Republican conventioners see. So we're actually talking about a very different type of reality for sex workers here in New York.
Juhu Thukral, I want to thank you for being with us. Is there a website that people can go to or wait?
sexworkersproject.org.
And can see the report,
yes.
Revolving Door, an analysis of street-based prostitution in New York City. That does it for today's program. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkaddous, Anna Nogueira, Elizabeth Press, Jeremy Scahill, John Hamilton, Mike DeFilippo, our engineer. Tomorrow, on Wednesday evening at the Berkeley Community Theater, I'll be there with Arundhati Roy and David Barsamian and Boots Riley. On Thursday at Tattered Cut, cover in Denver, Colorado. Go to our website at democracynow.org for the exception to the rulers tour. I'm Amy Goodman. Nell Geiser, thanks. Thanks for joining us.